Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamani Namaste Saraswata Deva Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pashatare Shatarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasri Gaur Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. We read from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 16, Verse 1. Suta uvacha tata parikshad vijavaya sikshaya mahi maha bhagavata sasasaha yata hi sucham abhijata kovida Samadishan Vipra Mahad Gunastataha. Sutta Goswami said, Tata, thereafter, Parikshit, Maharaj Parikshit, Dvijavarya, the great twice-born Brahmanas, Shikshaya, by their instructions, Mahim, the earth, Mahabhagavata, the great devotee, Sasasa, ruled, ha, in the past, yata, as they told it, he, certainly, sucham, at the time of his birth, abhijata kovida, expert astrologers at the time of birth, samadishan, gave their opinions. Vipra, O learned Brahmanas. Mahatguna, great qualities. Tata, true to that. Translation, Suta Goswami said, O learned Brahmanas, Maharaj Parikshit then began to rule over the world as a great devotee of the Lord under the instructions of the best of the twice-born Brahmanas. He ruled by those great qualities which are foretold by expert astrologers at the time of his birth. Report. At the time of Maharaj Parikshit's birth, the expert astrologer Brahmanas foretold some of his qualities. Maharaj Parikshit developed all those qualities, being a great devotee of the Lord. The real qualification is to become a devotee of the Lord, and gradually all the good qualities worthy of possession develop. Maharaj Parikshit was a Mahabhagavata, or first-class devotee, who was not only well versed in the science of devotion, but also able to convert others to become devotees by his transcendental instructions. Maharaj Parikshit was therefore a devotee of the first order, and thus he used to consult great sages and learned brahmanas who could advise him by the shastras how to execute this state administration. Thus great kings were more responsible than modern elected executive heads because they obliged the great authorities by following their instructions left in Vedic literatures. There was no need for impractical fools to enact daily a new legislative bill and to conveniently alter it again and again to serve some purpose. The rules and regulations were already set forth by great sages like Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parasara, and other liberated sages, and the enactments were all suitable for all ages and all places. Therefore, the rules and regulations were standard and without flaw or defect. Kings like Maharaj Parikshit had their council of advisors, and all the members of that council were either great sages or brahmanas of the first order. They did not accept any salary, nor had they any necessity for such salaries. The state would give the best advice without expenditure. Would get the best advice without expenditure. They were themselves samadarshi, equal to everyone, both man and animal. They would not advise the king to give protection to man and instruct him to kill the poor animals. Such council members were not fools or representatives to compose a fool's paradise. They were all self-realized souls, and they knew perfectly well how all living beings in the state would be happy both in this life and in the next. They were not concerned with the hedonistic philosophy of eat, drink, be merry, and enjoy. They were philosophers in the real sense, and they knew well what is the mission of human life. Under all these obligations, the advisory council of the king would give correct directions, and the king or executive head, being himself a qualified devotee of the Lord, would scrutinizingly follow them for the welfare of the state. The state in the days of Maharaj Yudhisthira or Maharaj Parikshit was a welfare state in the real sense of the term, because no one was unhappy in that state, be he man or animal. Maharaj Parikshit was an ideal king for a welfare state of the world. Translation, Suta Goswami said, O learned brahmanas, Maharaj Parikshit then began to rule over the world as a great devotee of the Lord under the instructions of the best of the twice-born brahmanas. He ruled by those great qualities which were foretold by expert astrologers at the time of his birth. So the previous verse discussed the departure of the Pandavas after they voluntarily resigned, and they decided to give up their bodies. But it was mentioned that they put Parikshit in charge. In other words, they fulfilled their responsibility of making sure that the government would go on by putting in place a qualified person. And of course, at that time, the qualified person was a descendant in their line. In fact, the whole Bhagavatam is from the third canto on, traces out the lineage from Swayambhuva Manu down, and then later on from Vaivasvata Manu down, until we come to the Rishni dynasty, etc. And so all of these were in lines, hereditary lines, father to son. And they were qualified as leaders of the world. This was a setup of the Supreme Lord. Every day of Brahma, he appoints and empowers Manus and their descendants to rule the earth. Okay? So they are called Vibhutis of the Lord. So they have special power to do that. So obviously, because they're appointed by the Lord, like the Devatas, they're devotees of the Lord.
Of course, some are greater devotees than the others. Sometimes we get a little mishap, as we see in the case of King Vena popping up. And then they had to kill him because he was so demoniac. And then they started the line from his son, Prithu. There may be some mishaps due to nature of the material world, but generally those who are coming in that line are qualified persons. Hmm? So what is their qualification as a ruler? Of course, there should be a kshatriya. At the same time, they should be a devotee. As a kshatriya, they have to also not only have the mode of passion, but also the mode of goodness. They have to have knowledge of scriptures. Then they have to be devotees. This makes an ideal leader. So Parikshit, as described here, assumed the throne, and he had all the great qualities, Mahaguna, which were predicted by the astrologers. So it was a custom when a person was born, they would call the astrologer to see the future of that child. And particularly the royal families would do that because they wanted to make sure the person was qualified to take up the throne. So the astrologers came and they made all wonderful predictions about his future. The astrologers seemed to be qualified because their predictions came true. And he manifested all the wonderful qualities that were predicted. The first lines here talk about him ruling the kingdom, and one of the major qualifications was Mahabhagavata. He was a great devotee of the Lord. But the other one was Dvijavarya Sikshaya. How did he rule? He ruled by taking instructions from the best of the Dvijas, the best of the Brahmanas. So he was submissive to the Brahmanas. We see that the Varna system is classified according to gunas. So Sudras are dominantly tamagun, Vaishyas are tamagun, rajagun, Kshatriyas are rajagun, sattvagun, and Brahmanas are sattvagun. So we also know that of the gunas, sattvagun is superior to the rest, and this is praised in Bhagavad Gita. Sattvagun is the best of the gunas. So, therefore, in the Varna system, the Brahmanas are at the top. They're not at the top in terms of ruling, and the Kshatriya is the ruler, but the Brahmanas are at the top. So this is a rather, for the Western world, this is a little bit strange. The top person is the ruler. In the European society, the king was the top person. But here we find that the Brahmana, who is not the ruler, is the top person. So how is that possible? It's only possible because the Kshatriya respects the Brahmana. And he puts them in the top position. He gets the advice of the Brahmanas and then he follows their order. In that sense, the Brahmana is at the top. And therefore he's the most powerful. In terms of practical power, of course, the king is still the head administrator of the country. But he takes his advice from the Brahmanas and gives them respect, and therefore they maintain their position at the top. Because, as I said, sattva is superior to rajagun and tamagun. Now, the kshatriya has a combination of rajagun and sattvagun. If he has no sattvagun, it will be very difficult for him to follow the advice of the Brahmana. So therefore, someone who's only in rajagun, he's not really qualified as a kshatriya. He cannot rule properly. Definitely he can rule, but he will exploit everybody for his own purposes. So therefore, the real kshatriya has to have some sattva. and that sattva allows him to follow the brahmanas, and sattva allows him to be more objective and more detached from his position, because the quality of sattva is inner happiness, which means we are not too attached to the enjoyment of the senses. So therefore he has less attachment to his position as the ruler, less attachment to that enjoyment. So therefore the real kshatriya has to be a combination of sattva and rajas, rather than pure rajas. So, of course, sattva gun is not also the ultimate quality. This is a material quality. So as far as material qualities, yes, good. But devotion is higher than that. That's spiritual quality. So the king cannot just be a mixture of raja and sattva, rajas and sattva. He also has to have the highest quality of all, that is devotional qualities. In this way he can rule. It is said that bhakti is independent and everything else is dependent on bhakti. So karma yoga appears to be independent because you just do your sacrifices and worship devatas and you go to Svarga Loka. But it is pointed out that that doesn't really work. If you offend the Supreme Lord, then you can't even get to Svarga Loka. Similarly, the Varnashram system also will not work unless that king is a devotee, and there is some there are traces of devotion within that whole setup of Varnashram. So it's, nothing is independent. If the Varnashram system is to succeed properly, it must have a devotional element in there. Now, in traditional society, it may not be so strong because not everybody is qualified for bhakti. And therefore, we have the system of karma, yoga, and dharma, etc. for people in general, because they're not so qualified. They're more interested in artha and kama. They want to take care of themselves and their family. That's their main primary concern in life. Everything else, secondary. Nevertheless, they also have to have some theistic faith as well. That is inculcated in the whole system. But their primary objective is artha and kama. So the leader of the country has to balance out very well, because if he only has the artha, dharma, kama tendency, then he can't really succeed unless he has that bhakti also. Maybe a little bit, but at least yes, there's something there. Yeah. And this will make the system successful. So therefore the king is in a rather delicate position. He has to rule, he has to follow the brahmanas, he has to follow the Supreme Lord. He's got two authorities there, brahmanas and Supreme Lord. And still he has to rule the country and act like the Supreme Person, but he's under someone also. So this is the system that is set up in the Varnashram system. And it may be a little difficult to find someone for that post. So that's why the whole post is appointed and empowered by Supreme Lord himself. And they have hereditary lines of kings empowered by Supreme Lord, so that the system will go on nicely. So, some of the line people in the line, the descendants of Manu, are very great devotees. Some are ordinary devotees. Some have a little less. So we see here, Parikshit was a very great devotee. So he's Mahabhagavata, very, very prominently a devotee, even though he is the king. So his devotional qualities were outstanding, and that is mentioned in other places in the Bhagavatam. Even as a child, he was thinking of the Supreme Lord. Playing, when he was playing, he was thinking of the Supreme Lord, etc. So he didn't have he didn't deviate in his mind from the Supreme Lord. Moreover, when he was before he was born in the womb, he got the blessings of the Lord and he saw the Lord because the Lord saved him. So he was, we can say, benedicted by the Lord also. to have a very special role because the Lord protected him in the womb. So that's why he's such a great devotee. So it is said that because he saw the Lord in the womb, when he came out, he was always looking for the Lord. So that's why we have the word parikshit. Iksha means to see. And pari means everywhere. So he was looking everywhere to see that Lord that he saw in the womb. So that was his natural quality, to always desire to see the Lord. So naturally, when he became king, then he was also a great devotee. But we see here that he followed the advice of the brahmanas, the best of the dvijas. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita there, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes the hierarchy of life, we have plants, and then we have animals, and then we have human beings, and then we have human beings who have varnashram system, then among those we have the brahmana. And then superior to the brahmana is the brahman who is actually following. He's not only brahmana in name only, but he's actually following very properly. He's a better brahman. Of course, better than that is the Vaishnava. So the Dvijavarya, the good brahmanas, these are the ones that are following. They've studied the Vedas. They know the conclusion of the Vedas. They follow the Vedas. They've developed wisdom as well, not just knowledge, but they do have wisdom. They have some realization. And therefore, they're qualified to teach. These were the type of brahmanas that he had. Dvija, of course, means twice born. One is born from the womb. That's the first verse of first birth. And, of course, all animals get that birth. So second birth is to get the Brahma Gayatri mantra, and then be qualified to study the Vedas. So this is given to Vaishyas, Kshatriyas, and Brahmanas. And of those, the Brahmana is considered to be superior because he should have subtle good qualities. So he's the one that usually studies the Vedas more than the other two Varnas. So in this way, they are Dvija. If they study the Vedas and they know the Vedas, they are Dvija, and not in name only, but by qualification, study. If they don't study the Vedas, then they simply get the ceremony and get the mantra, but they don't do anything with it. They don't even know what the mantra means. Then they are Dvija in name only. So, of course, we can even say that the mantra itself, that is the Brahma Gayatri mantra, though it is taken by the smartas to be a regular punya, actually it is also a glorification of the Supreme Lord. So it's, we can say it's a Vaishnava mantra. Why? Because it's a glorification of Vishnu. So therefore, if one gets that mantra, one is getting initiated as a Vaishnava, technically speaking. And if one chants the mantra every day and meditates on Vishnu, very good. Then one can advance in devotional service. But unfortunately, different brahmanas will have different interpretations of that mantra, and some will say it's Shiva, some will say it's Suryadeva, etc. So that way, the meaning gets lost, and therefore not every dvija is a Vaishnava. It should be, but they're not, practically speaking. So anyway, the best of the dvijas are the brahmanas, and the best of the brahmanas are those that not only go through the ceremony, but also learn the Vedas, learn the conclusion, practice the Vedas, and get some sort of realization. Then they're qualified to teach the king. So therefore, they are highly respected persons. We can apply the same standards to devotees also, not just brahmanas, but devotees. As is mentioned in the purport, he says that one should not only be qualified with the Vedas, one should also be able to teach it properly and to convince other people about it. So that's actually the definition of the Vaishnav given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The first year when everyone said, who's a Vaishnava? The Lord Chaitanya said, anyone who chants once the name of the Lord, he's a Vaishnava. Then they were a little puzzled by that, and next year they came back from Navadvipa and they came to Puri and they asked the same question, who's a Vaishnava? Lord Chaitanya said, anyone who chants continuously, he's a nice Vaishnava. So they were satisfied with that. Then next year they came back and they asked the same question, who's a Vaishnava? And Lord Chaitanya said, anyone upon whom seeing, he makes you chant, he inspires you to chant the holy name, he's a Vaishnava. Yeah. So therefore the best Vaishnava is the one who can inspire others to chant. But how can he do that? He has to chant purely. How can he chant purely? He has to get knowledge. So we say that without knowledge you're in namabhas. So that's impure chanting. We're unclear about who's God, and if we're unclear about what's pure bhakti, etc. What is the goal? So we need some knowledge. I may want to get the knowledge from scripture and devotees. So we have to take a devotee association, get the knowledge, then we can get to pure bhakti. But even that's not enough. It's not that you just learn the books, etc. You have to practice. So part of getting the knowledge is practicing it. So we have these three steps in knowledge. Sambandhagyan, that's the knowledge part. We have abhideya, the practice part. And we have prayojan, the goal. All three things are necessary. We have to do all three. We have to know all three. So we get the knowledge and then we have to practice. And that qualifies us to be the best Vaishnava. And with that, then we can preach to others, we can convince others, and make them into good Vaishnavas. If we just have the knowledge but we don't have the practice, then what can we do? Therefore, the knowledge plus the implementation is very necessary. Then we have the potency to communicate that knowledge to others and inspire others to adopt the process. So Parikshit Maharaj was very highly qualified, and that was of course predicted by the astrologers. But we should not think that you see, karma is predicted by astrology. That's all it does. It's a material science to predict your karma of this lifetime. So was Parikshit subject to karma? If not, then how could he be such a great devotee if he was under the law of karma? So actually, like the Pandavas, he's also an eternal associate of the Lord. So he's not under karma. But the Lord makes arrangement that even the devotee seems to follow a path of karma. So he gives him a birth such that his karma looks very good from the material point of view. So in other words, he arranges not only for spiritual auspiciousness of the devotees, but also the material auspiciousness. So whatever is auspicious for them, it's arranged according to karma. Of course we see that it was good karma, but then we had an unfortunate incident. He got cursed at a young age and he had to die in 7 days. Bad karma in one sense, if that's bad karma. So that again is arrangement of the Lord. It's not real karma. It's not. Of course, one could probably, in the Mahabharata, maybe there's a story of why he got cursed and Shringi and whatever, why it was, what was their relationship in the previous lifetime or something. But nevertheless, ultimately, it's the arrangement of the Supreme Lord for his pastimes. Yeah. And we cannot blame Parikshit for having faults like pride and impatience and hunger and thirst and whatever, therefore pride in insulting the brahmana, and we should never find fault, and we should never find that he is subject to karma, because he's a devotee of the Lord, and he's even if he's a devotee, he's not under the law of karma, because he is bhakti destroys all the karma. So therefore, not really under astrology of these what is mentioned here. Huh? So, but the we can say that the astrology simply follows according to the plan of the Lord, and then he is there. That is the case also. Sometimes people make the chart of Ramchandra or Krishna and say, okay, this predicts that Ramchandra, this is his qualities and this is what he will do, or this is these are Krishna's qualities according to his chart. But that's all secondary. the Supreme Lord is never under karma or astrology. He's transcendental. He will just appear and he will make arrangements such that the good qualities of astrology, which are predicted in astrology, is also manifest in his chart, that's all. But that's an aspect of the Lord's power. He can do that. So therefore, the devotees and the Supreme Lord are not actually under the law of karma. They are independent of that. The devotees are under the supervision of the Supreme Lord, and all their activities are guided by him rather than anything else. So whatever happens here in the story of Parikshit is the will of the Supreme Lord, and we can't attribute any fault to Parikshit. Okay, any question there?
Maharaj, at the beginning of the talk, you said you were talking about the Manus suing laws, and you said they were applicable at all times and places. But it was funny, some of these laws, like Manu Samhita and so on, it doesn't seem like it's practical in Kali Yuga, even though we hear that it is at all times and places, but now it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Though the laws are perfect because they are scriptural, we do need a proper administrator, a descendant of Manu, to implement the laws at a particular time, because the details are always subject to time and place. That's why we need someone to judge everything at the time and place. And if they can't do that properly, then the laws get misapplied. So all the laws are applicable, but then they're applicable within the time and circumstance as well. Yeah. If they didn't need that, then we just have the books and everybody follow the book and implement the law. But it's very complicated because we have so many cases which aren't covered by the law, so we got to make judgment on them. If this is the case, then what do we do here like that? It's just like in the country. Any country has laws. But we need someone to interpret the law. So therefore we have the judge. And then the people, based on that, we can say right or wrong or whatever, because the judge gives an opinion. Okay, this he did break the law here, or he didn't break the law. And that's because there are complications in applying justice and laws, etc., in all cases. Sometimes it's a matter of who's telling the truth or whatever, and sometimes it's a matter of the law itself is a little ambiguous. So, therefore, we need someone to very wise who can apply the law properly at every particular time. And therefore, it may look like it, the law is subject to time and place or whatever, but actually it's just the application of the law. The principles are absolute for us, and then the application may be slightly changing according to the circumstances. Well, there's a little, we can say, like Ajahn didn't have any karma, for instance, when he chanted the name accidentally once. All his karmas, present and future, gone. Yamaraj couldn't touch him, not no karmas. So, yet we see people seem to have karmas, etc. So, the case of Ajahn was, he had no offenses, and therefore all the karmas got destroyed. That's one thing. And if we do have offenses, then all the karmas are not quite destroyed, so there's still some karmas left.
So we can still make karma, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, of course you can make karmas, but if you chant the holy name once purely, or just accidentally, namabhas even, with no offenses, even you make more karmas, there's no effect. As in the case of Ajamil, after he chanted the name, he still committed sinful activities, but Yamaraj still couldn't touch him. So that's the power of even chanting the holy name once in Nama Bas. But as I said, if we do have some offense involved, then the process is a little slower. The other point is that even if Ajamil did destroy all of his karmas, it didn't look like all of his karmas were destroyed. Because he looked like exactly the same person. He didn't suddenly turn into a pure devotee or anything when he was and followed Dharma after he named his son Narayan. He didn't. He continued to do sinful activities. And he also didn't know he had changed. He was also surprised when the Yamadutas couldn't touch him. There is like an appearance of karma that goes on, even if your karmas are all destroyed. Okay? So if your karmas are destroyed, what is it? That's a pattern that the Lord keeps, or the holy name keeps. And it more or less hides its power, and that you get a pattern anyway. And that pattern will continue even for a person in prema. And so a prema bhakta also, he's definitely got no offense, he destroyed all of his karmas in via sakti stage, etc. But then he will get sick, he will get accident, and he will die. This looks like karma. So there's a pattern that looks like karma even for the prema bhakta. And the Lord keeps that pattern there as long as you've got a material body. So, but it's not karma as such, it's under the Lord at that point. So it's different.
At that point, when you're really advanced.
Yeah. And for people that are not advanced, even then, they may have destroyed all the karmas, but still they've got a pattern there. As in the case of Ajamil, who wasn't even a devotee, looked like the karma was still going on, but actually all his karmas were gone.
Because all through the Bhagavad Gita, constantly it's repeated that karma is destroyed only when the seed of desire or creative activities is totally eliminated. Krishna never said, but if you practice sadhana bhakti, then it doesn't matter. I'll take care of it. It's constantly repeated. The seed of creative activities and
well,
my point of view, myself and many devotees in ISKCON, there is still that seed.
Yeah, well, there's different levels. One is the result you're getting now in terms of karma. That's the result of your sinful activities. Huh? The actions themselves, of course, happened in previous lifetimes. What caused those actions? Desires. That's called the seed of sin. And then why the desires are there? And the ultimate cause is ignorance. So these are all causes of suffering in the material world. They all get destroyed by bhakti. But it's the karma that goes, and then the seed goes, and then finally the avidya, the ignorance goes, finally, in bhava stage. So they're gradually destroyed.
And also there is a verse here, the one that I was reading last night, and it says that even a liberated soul accepts his own body according to karma.
Even the?
In the Bhagavatam, 10.5, it said that even a liberated soul accepts his own body according to past karma.
Accepts his body if he's liberated? How do you mean?
That his body is product of his past karma.
Well, he may get liberated in his lifetime, but as long as he's got a body, that's the remnants of his past karma, so to speak. He's got a body. Of course, it is said that yeah, if your karmas were all gone, then your body would disappear. So if someone practices and he attains a state of liberation in his lifetime, his body should disappear, yeah? Because he's got no more karma, but he's got a body, so that's called the Jivan Mukta state. So that little bit of karma continues until he dies and he gives up that body. Yeah? But as for the devotee, in one sense, if he gets prema, he still has a body. That's not karma at all. It's simply the will of the Lord that body is maintained, but it looks like it's karma. So it goes to the appearance of karma, but actually it's the will of the Lord.
And also sometimes I find it a little bit confusing how devotees, every single thing is if Krishna wants. Well, for example, I heard some devotees say that this coronavirus is Krishna.
The what?
Coronavirus is Krishna who arranged that.
Well, ultimately we say everything in the creation of the material world and all the birth and death of the material is ultimately under Krishna, but we say it's indirect also, because why does Mahavishnu create the material world? It's only because the jivas have desires, material desires. That's why he does it. then within the material world, why we have the law of karma operating, because we have jivas who want to enjoy in the material world, etc. Why do they suffer? It's not that the Lord wants them to suffer, but they do actions, and according to that law, then they suffer because they do actions which are bad and sinful, therefore they suffer. So they create their suffering. It's not that the Lord creates it in that sense. It's the jiva and his free will that does this. Yeah, so we do have karma throughout our life based on previous activities. This will determine a birth when we're born, the body we get. It will determine our death when we give up the body. And then there are certain incidences there which are indicated, like marriage or sickness, whatever like this, different things, or promotion in job or whatever. Different things are there. But then, even with that pattern, we have our free will, and then we can wake up in the morning and we decide to do this or decide to do that. That's not the law of karma operating. And our karma may say one thing, okay, you're going to be wealthy or whatever, okay, fine. But then, by my free will, I can spend and waste all the money, and then I'm a pauper. So it's not that everything is, karma. We have our free will in this lifetime, and that more or less reinforces the karma, or helps us go worse than the karma, worse than we are, if we do a lot of sinful activities in this lifetime, and make it worse for ourselves in this lifetime. Or on the other hand, with knowledge, we do our activities, we can better ourselves and even get out of karma. So it's not that karma is forcing us to do every single act and making us do things. Yeah? But we still have our free will to do activity. It's karma gives us a circumstance, then we use our free will to choose how to do an activity. And by doing that, we can reinforce our karma and make it worse, or we can choose to make it better. So that's where the free will operates. Of course, if you're in the mode of ignorance, it's more likely that you won't choose to do your any good activities. You just fight against your karmas in the most tamasic way, and this only makes things worse. So that's why in the Vedic system, there's not much liberty given to the sudras. They don't get many choices, because they will make the wrong choices. They're told what to do. You do this, 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 and this. And then you do it, you follow. As a sudra, if you have a good sudra, then you follow what they say, what Shifter says, or what the brahmana says, then you follow it, then you're okay. And if you don't want to follow it, then you end up more suffering. As you go up in the scale, then, and you become Brahman, then you can start thinking independently even, and then you can start, of course, then you're willing to follow the scriptures, understand the scriptures, understand the purpose of the scriptures, etc. So you got much more flexibility in your choices at that stage.
It seems like in my own life, like what I think is free will, I'm actually just acting on previous experiences. So how do we understand that we have free will at the same time that Krishna is, we say that no blade of grass moves without Krishna, willing it to allow it to move. So how do we coincide?
Yeah, well, ultimately everything depends on the will of the Lord. Your very existence depends on the Lord. Without you, Krishna saying exist, you can't exist. And then to fulfill all your desires again, without the will of the Lord, you can't even operate your senses or move or anything ultimately. But then generally, he consigns it over to devatas, and so many other factors are there so that you can operate your body in this world. So we do, because we are human beings, and we have a mind, we have memory, etc., our past experiences are valuable for us. Because we can start discriminating, okay, that was not so good, I didn't get a very good result here, and I've done that many times, so maybe I shouldn't do that anymore. So that's a good use of intelligence, discriminating power. Bad use is you just ignore everything, forget it all, or even if it was, you just ignore it and you just keep doing the same bad activity and getting worse results each time. So that's not following your your recollections or your experience. So experience is definitely valuable for us, but then you have to take advantage of it as a human being. Yeah? A person that can do that, then he can progress. A person that doesn't, then he fails. That's what the law of karma is for, just to make you realize that. And of course, behind that we get not only the experience of this lifetime and previous lifetimes also backed up somewhere in our brain, which we can't remember, but somewhere the intuition is there. So that's to our advantage also. Even the previous lifetimes experiences are also there. So that gives us a little advantage if we can access our experiences and learn from them. If we don't learn from experiences, then we're more like animals. That's a qualification for bhakti, as we say, trinadapi suni china trorapi se shuna. So it's an initial qualification, and we can say at the beginning of bhakti itself, it is an essential element. And as I described in the story of Gopakumar there, I mentioned that, you know, ultimately, as you progress in bhakti, the humility must become greater. And then it's the greatest in the greatest devotees. And the greatest devotees are the gopis. And the gopis are the most humble. So if we are going against that at the very beginning of our sadhana, then it's very difficult for us to advance at all. So therefore it has to be, we can say, cultivated from the, or you can say it's intrinsic in the whole process of bhakti from the very beginning. So if we don't have that, forget about bhakti, we can say in one sense. So, it's not perfect in the beginning, but we have to let it grow, and with the growth of bhakti, then that humility should grow. If it doesn't grow, it means our bhakti really isn't growing also. There's something wrong there. Okay. Oh. It doesn't mean they don't have any goodness at all. Sure, they may have, but it's they're prominently that. Yeah,
yes,
that's all.
Kind of the question is, should it start also at all in the material world?
If you attain prema, then you're in Sudasattva. Beyond everything in the material world, you've transcended the gunas. Otherwise, no, it's always a mixture. Someone's going to, your body gets affected by the gunas, and the environment is gunas, etc. All we can do is choose better gunas, better sattvic food over tamasic food, sattvic environment over tamasic environment, sattvic association over tamasic association. That's how we can at least do something to influence the gunas on us. But then, of course, better than that is bhakti, nirguna. So prasadam instead of sattvaguna food, a devotee association over sattvaguna association. The transcendental environment over sattvic environment. Hare Krishna.